Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is James. Check out our website, MacGuffinMan.com. We most recently talked about Cloverfield and 10 Cloverfield Lane. It was sort of a joint podcast. And then before that was Anomalisa, and before that was Spotlight. I also wrote a thing about Sia and a pop punk band called Modern Baseball. And in a couple days, I'll be putting out something about Terrence Malick. So a lot of things on the website. Check them out. Follow us on Twitter, at the MacGuffin Man. And that's about it. Let's start the episode.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes.
What are we talking about today?
The Third Man.
Yeah.
1949's The Third Man.
Mm-hmm. Directed by Carol Reed, written by Graham Greene.
Yeah, one of the, I'd say one of the lesser known of the sometimes considered greatest of all time.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Usually not considered number one, but pretty high on a lot of people's list.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope I'm not putting you on ignorance blast here, but I think you assumed it was a newer movie, you know, although I had just said it, I saw it in a theater, so I think that was part of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it is weirdly, I don't know, watching that movie, I felt like it fits with those classics and maybe should be talked about more. And I think maybe part of it is just because the only... like famous person that most people know involved in the movie in any capacity is Orson Welles. And he has a relatively small role. I mean, but he's also just as far as like, I don't know, he's not like Clark Gable to talk about with people. You know, Orson Welles has a weird, complicated history that everybody kind of knows a little bit about and isn't sure if they're allowed to like Orson Welles, you know?
Yeah, no, I think so. That's true. And I think, yeah, as I said, it's just... you know, some of these actors would have been known very well in their time. And as time continues, some movies stay very relevant. Some actors' names kind of fade. And yeah, Orson Welles is a gigantic figure in cinema. But he's only got, I think, 5 minutes of screen time in this.
Is that true? Just five?
Yeah. And wow. He's really not in it that much. So, yeah. Yeah, 1949, I mean, this is, you know, still kind of in Orson Welles' better era, I think, as well,
yeah,
as people
exactly.
would sort of look at it in hindsight.
Yeah, and he is yet to look super unhealthy, which he would by the time he's doing, like, Touch of Evil. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's still, he still looks vital, you know, like, which is a terrible way to say it, but anyway.
And in his small role in this, I mean, his important, but, you know, not large as far as screen time role is concerned. Yeah. I really like him in this. He's
awesome.
Yeah. He's fun. I mean, he's tough. I think part of this movie is, you know, that combination of wanting to like something and accepting the reality for it. And I mean, that shows up in the visuals and the themes and a lot of kind of the iconic, you know, cuckoo clock speech and just in the arc that Holly takes in general in this movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So where do you want to start with this one?
I don't know. I think we started with Orson Welles. Should we just... He somehow doesn't show up until like an hour and 5 minutes into the movie, but minute one of our podcast. You know? I don't know. It's...
Well, I think... I
assume you like this movie. I'm curious to know if I was right.
Yeah, no, I did like it a lot. And I think I liked
really
it.
Good.
I think I like it more and more as it goes on. Yeah. It's not as though the beginning's awful and the ending is... just so much better, but I do really kind of like the way it builds. I like not seeing Orson Welles for so long, as much as I do like him on screen. I think his entrance with the cat and his face showing up in the light, I think, is really good. And I like I do just kind of like the very ending of this movie a lot too, but I'm sure we'll get there. And I think another thing that kind of makes this an Orson Welles movie, despite you know, his relatively short amount of screen time, is there's a popular misconception that he directed this movie.
Yes.
And this is, you know, at a time when he, you know, had proven himself to be a talented director, and was, you know, just a very famous person. And I think basically that just kind of speaks to, first, how famous he was at the time, how well regarded he was, because this movie was received very well, especially in America and the United Kingdom, not so much in Austria, interestingly, but it was received as a, you know, very good movie at the time. I think with time passing, it's been regarded in certain circles as even better than originally perceived, and as we discussed, in kind of general culture, sort of fading constantly.
Yeah.
But, you know, he wasn't on the set very long. I mean, he had so little screen time. He showed up 2 weeks late anyway, ended up being there only for a week. But yeah, I think it has some of the themes that we would see in Citizen Kane, that just, you know, male friendship and betrayal and sort of the dark side of powerful people and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of people, when talking about this movie, and the rumor that was seemed to exist that he kind of, Orson Welles kind of ghost directed the movie, they're quick to say, like, no, Carroll redirected this movie, but the influence of Orson Welles as a director is very strong in the film, you know? Carroll Reed had watched and loved a lot of Orson Welles movies, you know, as most directors did. You know, because Orson Welles as a director has proven so influential.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant. I don't think I explained it that clearly, but just not just that he was famous, but that he was so influential. It wasn't just a face and name you knew, but someone who had such a huge indelible mark on cinema, and some of the visual techniques and some of the storytelling methods that came in the next, or that were so popular in the next few decades, were just because of the movies he had directed in Citizen Kane and just the massive impact that he had. So years down the line, when you say, oh, this looks like Orson Welles made it, it's because Orson Welles influenced so many people in the time period that, you know, you just see his mark on it, even though he's not actually a director.
Yeah, there was, this is just a bit of an Orson Welles story that I feel like you'd appreciate. There were...
like all Orson Welles stories.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody likes a good Orson Welles story. For the first, I think, couple of days that he was on set, he wouldn't come out of his hotel room. I think there was some sort of disagreement that was going on. He just decided he wasn't going to come out of his hotel room. And so Carroll Reed needed to get him on set after a couple of days, and knew that Orson Welles liked magic. So Reed found the best magician in the area and brought him to the hotel and said that if Orson Welles came out of his hotel room, he would get the magician to do a show for him, and it worked.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful Orson Welles story, one of a thousand that exist.
Yeah, and on a similar note, I guess he didn't want to do anything in the sewers.
Yes, he did not like being down there.
And I think one thing I'm sure we'll get to, but one of the things that's so cool about this movie is that it was shot on location in Vienna. Yes. You know, this is 1949. This is not long after the conclusion of World War II. And to look at those things and to think about those not being sets, that to be the location that not only is a movie being shot on, but where people are living and, you know, working is pretty incredible. And I think one of the things that adds so much of kind of the flavor of this movie is that appearance.
Yeah, and like at the time in 1949, it's just in general very uncommon to shoot movies on location. And
Yeah,
exactly. Like if we're looking at the noirs that we've talked about before on the podcast, The Maltese Falcon, right? Like that's such a studio set sort of noir. Whereas with The Third Man, it adds that element of realism. Like the movie has been talked about as a decent example of neorealism in that they use real sets, and there are a lot of real normal people in this movie as actors, you know?
Yeah, just so. Local people as extras. And I think this is the first British production to be shot mostly on location. And, you know, later with a lot of kind of spy movies or thrillers or you know, globetrotting kind of movies. We don't get that. We get, I mean, it's like later on we do get that kind of thing, but this is just really kind of unprecedented
for the time. Sorry. We were talking about the sewers and I.
Right. Yeah. Just, he didn't want to do the shooting in the sewers. And I mean, such an important part of the movie is the sewer scenes, and so many things about it make that so important. But I just wanted to bring up that they ended up building a lot of sets for him, and they ended up using a lot of body doubles for him, for Orson Welles, for Lyme in the sewer shots. And, mm-hmm. you know, him reaching for the grate is actually Carol Reed's hands and things mm-hmm. like that. So, yeah, it's just so interesting that one of the things that it's so noted for is this, the ability to shoot on location like this, that Orson Welles just put up such a big fight.
Yeah, he ended up doing a couple, like those, there are a couple shots of him actually in the sewers, but they're under very specific conditions that I don't remember anymore. Basically, when you can see Orson Welles' breath in the sewer, that's when he's actually in the sewer. And when you can't, he's in a set. Apparently, the first time he was brought down to the sewers, he was disgusted and gave a very loud, and this is according to Guy Hamilton, who I believe was Carol Reed's assistant at the time, or assistant director or something like that, and went on to be a director of a bunch of James Bond movies himself. But anyway, he's recounting the story, and Orson Welles just goes into this tirade about how people shouldn't be down here. It's unhealthy. It's horrible. It's disgusting. People are eating down here. This is gross. The last part of which I agree with him. You shouldn't bring food down to the sewers, and then you also shouldn't eat it down there. But he was just disgusted by the idea of having to be in the sewer. And since he was Orson Welles, they had to build a set for him. You know?
Right. So. Yeah. Back in London, and then move some production back there to get those shots. So yeah. Yes, catering to your talent a bit there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, and you know, there are numerous examples in this movie where, like we talked about his introduction shot, which is wonderful. You know, a lot of it, which is shot on location with a double. And then when we actually see his face, we're in a studio in London. Yeah.
And, just to go back to the sewers for one second, that, I mean, we've talked about how it's on location. That really is the Viennese sewer system for a lot of it. I mean, obviously not the ones with Orson Welles in it.
Yeah.
But that was, I mean, historically important. That there is a police division in Vienna just to monitor the sewer systems, because it's so big and intricate like that, and it's so easy to access at certain points, that that's somewhere people would store a lot of, you know, stolen items, or do drug deals, or meet up, or, you know, it's just a real part of the Viennese history, and the reality of what it would have been like to live there and be involved in the literal criminal underworld in this case. So
yeah, exactly.
And just adding one more thing to how real it was. And, you know, I think we see how easily that ties into, you know, what the story is about. So many people are, you know, smuggling or selling contraband, and it's all about this, you know, big black market. And that's, you know, what Lyme's character, his involvement in this story is because of, you know, him stealing penicillin and diluting it and selling it to other people. So it does serve as this, you know, pretty clear but visually pleasing visual metaphor for the citizens of Vienna and, you know, the maybe not occupying military is the right term, but all the shady dealings that of authority and some of the population of the city as well.
Yeah, for sure. And just as a quick tidbit about the further adding realism to that, some of those actual sewer police are playing the role of the sewer police in the movie.
And I mean, they make such great visuals. I mean, tunnels, I mean, the symmetry of them can make for such great shots. And just for the nature of film noir, which I don't think we've really touched on in broad strokes lately, is about often in, you know, cities and alleyways and sewers and things like that, about kind of the world closing in on you and claustrophobia and the way that it's kind of such a labyrinth. And we have these disorienting shots of people chasing each other. You know, just that feeling of disorientation, I think, is so common in film noir, when we have these subjective shots and we have all these Dutch angles, which are all over this movie as well. Just that, just that notion of subjective views, I think, is so important in film noir and in this film in particular. You know, it's about what you can see, and that's so much about the light and shadows that get played with constantly in film noir, and partially where the subgenre gets its name, and about what information you know. And it's about looking at the world from a certain perspective and having certain information, having certain beliefs. And that's, I think, the sewer system, other than just being extremely realistic, plays in so perfectly with some of the things that people love so much about noir.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So let's maybe go back to the beginning of the movie, because I feel like we'll end up, if we keep on this path, we'll end up talking about all the cool stuff that happens at the end and totally skim over the beginning. Because even before Orson Welles shows up, this movie's great. One thing that I thought you would really respond to, and again, I was lucky enough to see it in a full theater recently, on 35mm, no less, the shout-outs to the Lightbox for showing cool movies. But yeah, it was a movie I had never seen and always had on the list, but was sort of like assumed that at some point I would be have the ability to see like a screening of it, and I did, and it was great because seeing this movie with a theater full of people is really fun because it's very comedic and it's really enjoyable getting all of the laughter that comes along with the movie. Because that was one thing that I thought you would definitely really respond to is that, I mean, I knew you liked noir, but it's also a funny movie a lot of the time, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I agree. What got
And that was something I was totally caught off guard by. Like, I was not anticipating that, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, film noir, this isn't the only film noir to have very funny moments or moments of dark comedy, but this one really strikes an interesting chord, I find. I mean, the very light music intro kind of gets you expecting one thing, and I thought a kind of, I don't even know what to call it, a joke, but a nice juxtaposition is when we're getting that voiceover from what ends up being Calloway at the beginning, right?
I mean, it's the voice of the director. Is it supposed to be Calloway? No.
I think
it's Carol Reed's voice.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I might be mixing it up. The novella is written from Calloway's perspective, so okay. Maybe that's what it was. But just when he's discussing the black market and how it invites a lot of amateurs, and they show a dead body floating in a puddle.
Oh yeah,
you know, and it's over this light, string music. I thought that was it strikes you as a little weird at first, but as this movie plays out, you see that that is kind of the tone of this movie. It's, it's light and goofy at times as we kind of circle these really, really heavy issues, and darkly funny, and then heavy and just plain dark. But yeah, I was curious what your audience kind of laughed at the most, or what you found to be some of the better comedic material.
The one that got the closest it came to bringing the house down, it's not like people were losing their minds or anything, but was the he was quite dead scene where I forget who it is, but is talking to Anna. Like, he's trying to explain to Holly, like, what he means, because his English isn't his first language. And he's struggling with it. And he turns to Anna and he's like, what does this mean? And she says, he was quite dead. And then he turns back to Holly and says, he was quite dead. Like, he got it. He got it from Anna, you know? And that played really well. And the fact that Holly moves while this person has his back to Holly, so he turns back to a place that he isn't there and then has to do this extra turn. It's just these a lot of really small little subtle things. I don't know. I felt it all sort of added to this really interesting sort of feel for the movie for reasons that you've talked about. And it's part of the thing about the movie that really still this movie still feels very modern to me. Like, it's so, watching, like, obviously where it's placed and when it's made, it's so 1949 and how it's made, but the tone of it is so, it feels so modern. It's kind of like you know, it's so pessimistic about the world that you kind of have to laugh, because if you can't yeah. laugh at these things, there's no time to laugh ever, because the world is such a terrible place, you know? and that was, that's something that, you know, especially would really start to kick in the decades following this movie. But I found it really interesting to see that in a movie from 1949.
Yeah, no, I think it feels really modern as well. As you said, it deals with things that are so Vienna post-World War II, but it... Yeah. Yeah, I think the tone feels still very fresh.
Yeah, and the fact that Holly is a writer, and the way that they talk about what he has written and what he will write, like all of that stuff was, it felt like some just, I don't know, like pre-Charlie Kaufman sort of vibe, where it's just like we're making this movie that is this type of movie, but we're also talking about the process of writing, you know, as well, and what goes into me writing, how I feel about my writing, and how other people feel about it. You know, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and they're different movies, but I think it's a short line between this and something like Sunset Boulevard.
Yes, I agree.
For those reasons. With the comedy thing, and this comes partially as this being a bit of a fish out of water story, right? We have an American in Vienna. Yes. And so a lot of these jokes about translation and, you know, not being maybe familiar with everything about Vienna just as it's his first time there. And we catch him just as he comes into the country, I assume. I mean,
he's getting
to that
off
hotel,
the train,
leaving
right?
the airplane. Oh, yeah, leaving or the train,
airport.
Sorry. Yeah. It's that, again, part of that's the fish out of water, kind of lost in translation thing. But again, I think a lot of that is the really subjective nature of just the way that this story is told, and partially just noir in general. Mm-hmm. But we get the language miscommunications and things like that. And just getting people's names wrong constantly is something that works as a joke over and over sometimes. I think that the way that this movie is funny and just unsettling at the same time, it's about having incomplete knowledge and not knowing everything but still trying to fight your way through it. I mean, that's so much of the detective genre, and this is so close to a detective movie. I mean, I know he's not a detective, but he says it comes up that he's kind of playing one of the characters in his book. You know, you're not a cowboy. You're not someone who is up to solving these crimes and bringing people to justice and things like that. But it's there. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, part of that progression, as I said, about not knowing everything and the world kind of revealing itself as we get deeper and deeper into this movie, and something I touched on when I mentioned Citizen Kane briefly, is these male friendships and betrayal. I mean, this movie is about someone who comes to see his friend, or, you know, to attend his friend's funeral. He comes for a job and then finds that he's dead, right?
He comes to visit his friend, I believe there is a job involved. And yes, he finds out he's dead when he goes to Lime's apartment.
Right. And so then, you know, the ball really kind of gets rolling as far as the, you know, what would be the narrative proper of this. And he's an old friend, and by the end of this movie, he ends up killing him, I think, is what we're supposed to understand. But it's about that kind of slow, kind of depressing realization that this person that you knew for so many years and felt so extremely close to and would, you know, travel over the ocean for to visit is not the kind of person that you remember. And he's not the kind of person Anna leads you to believe he is. He's not the kind of person that our protagonist recalls. And I think that's part of the really dark nature of this, is that you have this friend that you cared about so much and you trusted, and the world has kind of turned him into this bad person, or maybe he was a bad person all the time. And this the situation in Vienna allows him to really profit off it and become the not great person that he always was deep down. And I think that's something that's really interesting about this story, and something interesting about noir in general, is that those shades of gray and the general downhill progression of your experience in the world, and as the world kind of gets to you, it kind of bringing you down a lot. And the kind of super light, funny intro of this movie and the very dark ending of this, I think, is to have it bookend with something so playful as the intro and the jokes at the beginning to the good guy not really winning and losing really several things in the process from a character standpoint, I think really gets to that downward trajectory of the story and the subgenre.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, in that opening narration, Holly is described as happy as a lark, you know, and which is just such a like playful way to describe somebody. You know, he's just a bird flying through the world, you know. And he's slowly, you know, figuring out. I mean, one of the first things he learns in the movie is that his best friend is dead. And then he starts to think that there's something fishy about that, and then slowly realizes that, yeah, his best friend is dead in like an emotional way, you know? And so like the first burial is a sort of, people think it's a literal burial, but it's more of a symbolic burial of who Harry once was. And then the last one is the burial of who he actually became, you know? And a lot of the movie is about, certainly once Holly starts to figure out who didn't die. It's really about Holly seeing the difference between the person he came to visit and the person he actually did visit, you know?
Yeah. The first funeral is, you know, unwittingly to anyone there.
Exactly.
Is the first funeral is the death of the Harry Lime that Holly knew as a kid or a teenager whenever they split their ways. But that's his death of the good part of him. And then the second burial is really that understanding that, yeah, he actually is dead now. But the guy that you knew died a long time ago. He died even before the beginning of this movie. He died sometime around when he diluted penicillin enough to kill several people and whatever else he got into that just isn't apparent through the storytelling, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we see a lot of the growth process in Holly throughout the movie, right? Like even just the way that he approaches his writing. I mean, he feels kind of down about it at the beginning and toward, you know, specifically when he's got that Wednesday night lecture or question session that he's giving. Also, that's another really big laugh in the movie is when he's like, what's happening? Where am I going? And then it's just this thing that he forgot about.
And a lot of that's a good reveal too. And
oh, it's a great reveal.
But a lot of the questions and how it's handled is very funny as well.
Yeah, for sure. And then how he starts talking about how he's starting to want to write things that are more fact-based, you know? And it's just sort of a something inside of him turning that he sort of feels more of a responsibility not to make just these frivolous sort of pieces of entertainment. And it's like, this movie itself, it's a... in the style of a movie that could have just been frivolous entertainment, but it's so fascinating because it touches on so many different things and the time that it exists within, which was a time that was real, you know, it really augments the movie in a way that has certainly helped it to be remembered for sure. You know, it's not just a little novelette anymore, you know, it's just this interesting film.
Yeah. And it's certainly a lot more than, a cat and mouse game. You know, there are, as I said, some very interesting chase scenes and some pretty visuals and things like that, but I think there's more to it.
Yeah, and you can still use your old cliches, but you can use them to be something interesting. I mean, when Holly kills Harry at the end, it's a very sort of sheriffy striking down the villain sort of ending, you know, and like you said, there's a real cat and mouse game throughout the movie, specifically in the sewer sequence. And those are very old cliches, but they're just done with a sort of weight that is based in fact, you know. It's interesting.
Yeah. And speaking of his writing and basing things in fact, in the turn he makes about writing things that aren't frivolous, we can look at his old stories as these romanticized versions of the old West, which I mean have been debunked in a lot of kind of neo-westerns as not be you know, movies like Unforgiven, kind of demythologizing the old West and saying it wasn't really a very glamorous and a lot of bad things happened to a lot of good people, and
and everybody died when they were like 32.
Yeah, and life wasn't good even for those 32 years. Yeah. And, you know, to I think that's why it's interesting that he writes the genre he does, because it's something that, I mean, this happened before Unforgiven as well, but
yeah. Oh, just, you know, I mean, all of Sergio Leone's movies are good examples of that. His westerns.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, taking kind of a more critical eye to it and less of this beautiful myth of the American cowboy and his moral code.
Yeah. It's the John Wayne versus the Man with No Name movies, basically.
Yeah, and just that Holly's getting away from writing these things the way that he got away from believing Harry was the guy he thought he was. You know, he's kind of accepting, maybe I have been looking back at my childhood or my relationship with this guy under a certain kind of nostalgic light, and always giving him the benefit of the doubt when he's someone who does these things, these horrible things to people just to make more money. And mm-hmm. I think that kind of demythologizing his own past comes with that. And that's really exemplified when he starts saying, you know, I'm going to write things based on fact now.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, you know, in the way that he sort of linked himself with Harry in his own life, like over time, like he felt like they were very close and that they're very similar people. I mean, their names are very similar structure wise, you know. I even accidentally mixed them up earlier in this podcast, you know, Harry and Holly. They're just close names. And the idea is that they're such similar people that then end up being so different. Yeah.
Right. But as the film progresses, he really very plainly one time corrects Anna saying, you got to stop calling me Harry. And
kind of
takes back his identity saying, we're you know, even if we are close in a lot of ways to you, I'm my own person. And as we learn more about the things Harry's willing to do for money, we understand why he's more adamant about rejecting that identity. Mm-hmm. What about the cuckoo clock speech?
Oh, I mean, the whole Ferris wheel sequence is just top drawer, like so good.
Yeah, I mean, I might have skipped over something, but that's just something I want to make sure we kind of get to in depth.
Oh, because yeah, we have to.
It seems to be probably the iconic scene. I think there are some moments and images that people hold on to more or equally, but I think as far as kind of a front to back scene, so much of what makes this movie good is all in the Ferris wheel scene.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And it's something else that was another thing that sort of struck me as being very modern about this movie, the way that they frankly sort of talk about villainy and the way that Lime is able to not see himself as a villain, or, you know, ignore the fact that he's a villain, at least, to be able to keep doing these things. Just the whole conversation about the nature of being evil, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, it's a discussion about the value of human life. And he says, you know, what if just some of these dots stop moving? You know, you're way up on the Ferris wheel. You don't see the faces of these people. And in real life, so many people are strangers. I mean, he probably never looked at the people who had to inject this penicillin to save their life, and that's what let him do it, is to see them as just dots.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, talking about the, as we have throughout this podcast, because it exists throughout the film, that juxtaposition of seriousness and comedy, or these grand issues and minutiae, it's a debate on the value of human life that takes place on a carnival ride. I mean, it's so serious and it's so goofy at the same time. And I do love the theme of their friendship, as you've probably noticed by me bringing it up frequently. Mm-hmm. I love the just.
Are you just waiting for me to turn evil eventually?
No. Just the discussion they have, you know, 100 feet up in the air in front of an open door on a Ferris wheel. Either one of them could so easily kill the other one. And, you know, they could do that with guns too, but to kind of put it out there and both of them stand right at the edge and still show that there still is that level of trust and appreciation of each other at that point. I think that's fantastic too.
Yeah, for sure. And especially the fact that they're on that Ferris wheel. I mean, one, it's sort of a symbol of being a child is going on carnival rides, you know?
Yeah.
And then they're talking about such adult things. And the fact that they're two key scenes together are on the Ferris wheel, like way above the ground, and then in the sewer way below. I think that's kind of interesting, and that there is no there's no real middle ground, you know. And things are constantly askew in this movie. I mean, very early on, right when Holly finds out that Harry is quote unquote dead from the I don't even know, the caretaker in his apartment building.
They call him a porter.
Porter, okay. Yeah. But the yeah, the porter who immediately points up and says hell and points down and says heaven, right?
Yeah, and
then that's
great.
Also the first scene where we get the Dutch camera angle is right when we find out when we see those shots of that porter. Is when Holly's world starts to become askew, right? So we get the Dutch angle, which is the camera on a tilt, you know, and is something that is used throughout the movie. But I think that's it's really concentrated in that first scene when things really kick up. And yeah, there's just something is always kind of askew, and there's this sort of, you know, what is good and what is evil. And sometimes the two things, you know, heaven is up and hell is below, and sometimes there's some intermingling with the boat with the two of them in this movie, you know.
Yeah, and the Dutch angle just kind of makes you think about perspective in general, and the confusion of heaven and hell is, you know, just a little laugh. Oh, his English isn't perfect, you know, there's this funny little misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. But it points to this much deeper question.
And, yeah, exactly.
And yeah, what you said about the Ferris wheel versus the sewers, it's just the absolute heights and depths, you know, up on this Ferris wheel when things are up high and things are good. We're friends who can stand at the precipice of homicide and everything's okay. And mm-hmm. then when things are bad and the chase is on, we're trying to kill each other. And you can kind of beg and bring up our friendship and things like that, but it doesn't work. You can't get away with it. You know, just having a friendship many years ago isn't enough to get by any longer. And that's what brings about Harry's demise.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, no, it's great. And the way that Harry is able to be such a, I mean, the fact that Orson Welles is playing him is so important in this scene, because he is a charismatic villain, you know. He's like,
yeah, he's so good in that Ferris wheel scene.
I know, because he's such a likable performer, because he's so natural. Like he's kind of like towing the line between theatrical and then also what film acting would become. And right. He's a really sort of meet in the middle sort of thing, which I know is kind of different from the way we've been talking about things, but just the way that he is able to say such dark things and still kind of like, you kind of understand his justification. He's like, oh, I don't have to see them, they're just dots. And also
but with old man and everything sounds fine again.
yeah exactly. And and the way that he talks about as you said, the cuckoo clock part of the speech, where he's like, well, pain brought
the
Renaissance
here.
Yeah, okay, if you just want to read it.
Yeah, it's a, don't be so gloomy. After all, it's not that awful. Like the fella says, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgia, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace. And what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
Yeah. It's and like the way he exits the scene is really like Leonardo DiCaprio post Oscars speech, which is great. Like he really just swings on out of there. But yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And the fact that, you know, like part of that speech is, it's not hard to agree with some of the points that he's bringing up, that you know, strife sort of brings about good art. I mean, World War II brought us the third man eventually, you know. I'm not saying that World War II is worth
it,
happening.
But,
yeah, exactly. But the truth is there, and the fact that he is saying such dark things and then peppering them with something that I actually agree with, I think really continues on the thought of, you know, a thin line between good and evil.
Yeah, and there's a good book called Revel with a Cause, which is about how conservative things were during World War II and immediately after, and some of the amazing kind of countercultural art and, you know, the beatnik movement and all this, mm-hmm. All the so much very incredible kind of groundbreaking comedy that came out of it. And that stuff doesn't have that kind of backlash, doesn't happen without all this conformity and repression. So yeah, there's a point there, and it's just about not following someone too far down that path to mm-hmm. justify, well, I'm doing evil things, so good things can be the result of it, because that's very twisted logic. It's just when you have someone...
I'm doing this for art. I'm killing children for art.
Yeah, it's just when you have someone who's, you know, funny and charismatic and, you know, you knew from your childhood, it kind of makes a bit more sense. And, this movie is about Holly's struggle, about kind of negotiating those ideas, I feel.
Yes, I would agree.
And I think throughout it, I found a pretty hard Casablanca vibe. Did you get that as well?
Yes.
Yeah, but, we kind of have the split powers and around World War II and these corrupt officials and... Even the way that the romance kind of developed and ended, you know, we get this negative ending, a pretty bleak ending. And I think, from what I understand, Graham Greene, who I'm not totally familiar with a ton of his work, usually had sort of a more pessimistic, bleaker outlook. And he wanted the more hopeful ending that the novella had. Mm-hmm. And he just got in an argument with Carol Reed about it, and Reed really kind of wanted more of this downer ending. And Graham Greene has since admitted his mistake many times over and said that a lot of the power of this movie comes from that ending and that bleak, pessimistic attitude. And it's not give up on anything, nothing matters. It's, at least as far as I perceive it, that, you know, this war had this downside. It's not to say that you have to be depressed about it forever and give up on your national pride or anything like that. It's just when these massive world-changing wars like this happen, I mean, there's a very serious sense of loss. And despite what Harry says, things don't just balance out. You know, it's not a bad thing happens and a good thing happens and it's all equal. There are some just awful things that happen when people do awful things, or people let awful things happen, or people like Harry try to justify them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what makes the ending so powerful, is that there is this kind of sense of loss and this bleakness, and the guy doesn't get the girl, and the girl still seems to be unwilling to accept the true nature of the person that she had fell in love with. And, you know, I've talked a lot about subjectivity and incomplete perspectives and things like that. And I just don't think Anna ever figures it out, or she does and she doesn't want to believe it. And I think that's a powerful statement as well. Just the self-deception that runs throughout this movie too.
Yeah, for sure. And you're able to sort of look at whatever, like, we don't really get a lot of this movie from Anna's perspective. So we're left to kind of try and figure it out. And the fact that in that last scene, you can think of any number of things that she could be thinking. She's ignoring Holly because Holly turned on his best friend. She's ignoring Holly because she didn't like being used as sort of like a
bait. Or,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And she maybe still, and of course, she still possibly has conflicted feelings about Harry. You know, there's so many options that the movie just doesn't explore that it makes the length of that shot, which is, it's quite a long shot. I mean, it's gorgeous. I could have looked at it for another 20 seconds, you know, but it gives you enough time to sort of think about all of these things and then sort of wonder what she's actually going to do, and then see that she's just going to kind of ignore him, basically.
Oh, I fell in love with that shot before any of the interesting things about her turning him down came up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just looks so nice. And, you know, talking about him being an Old West author, you know, him leaning on the hay wagon and having a smoke,
sure.
And her walking, you know, down this perfectly symmetrical pathway, trees and gravestones everywhere. And it just seems like we might be falling back into cliche, or that we've overcome all this this gray, and now we're just going to get black hats versus white hats. And this is the good guy who did the right thing in the end, and he's going to reap the rewards. And it's not the case. And it's such a interesting ending to me. And I mean that in the best way possible.
Yeah. Have you read anything about the influence of drugs on this movie?
Yeah, that they're all doing Dexedrine and sleeping 2 hours a night,
yeah.
AKA speed.
Yeah, exactly. I really enjoyed that. So David O. Selznick is the American producer on this film, and he was such a workaholic that he would take this drug that people said would help him work longer. So he's just taking this drug, which is Dexedrine, which is speed, so that he could work like 22-hour days. And then according to his son, he would do this 6 days a week, and then on Sunday he'd fall asleep and sleep for 27 hours, you know, and of course would have to take a number of sleeping pills in order to do so. So welcome to the 40s, a time when humans treated their bodies well. And then the Carol Reed, like the way that the Third Man was shot, it was shot like it was a 24-hour production, basically, because there was a daytime unit, a nighttime unit, and a sewer unit. And Carol Reed wanted to oversee all of them. And the miracle drug known as Dexedrine was what allowed him to do that. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing how important drugs are to the existence of this movie, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. No, and it's absolutely, I mean, it's essential to the plot with penicillin, but it's,
yeah, it's true.
Had a pretty big role behind the scenes as well.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So should we talk about the sewer scene?
Yeah, like, sure.
Yeah, just like what actually happens, because, I mean, one of the wonderful benefits I had of seeing this movie in a movie theater is the sound in that scene is really great, and it was good to be assaulted by it, because I think that's kind of the idea. You know, I mean, we get that the whole chase of Harry's trying to get away. He goes to the part of the world that he feels like it's the safest in, because the underworld, it's the world that he has spent more time in than the law enforcement, you know. So, and he's just running away from them, and the whole thing's very gorgeous and wonderful. But then it gets to a point where he is hearing all of these different voices, right? He's in the center of this tunnel, and he's trying to figure out where the safe place is that he can go. So he's looking, do I go to this tunnel? Do I go to that tunnel? And he's getting all of these different voices coming out from each one. And it really sort of felt like your conscience closing in on you, like him sort of not even necessarily understanding that this is what he's coming to grips with, but the idea that all these voices are just shouting at him constantly as he's trying to get away from the evil that he's done. And I thought that was really cool and very expressionistic. And the fact that he then actually kills somebody that he can see later on in the chase, I think, is really interesting as well. And I think by the time that Harry dies, he understands what he's done. And I think the way that all of that is comes across, I thought the way that they did all of that was really good and very subtle. And I thought it was really interesting, you know, especially since we talked about the dots portion of the speech in the Ferris wheel, that specifically because he was far away from these people, he didn't care whether or not they lived or died. But now that he actually took a life that he could watch come out of the person's eyes.
He's in closed quarters. And
yeah, exactly.
This person isn't a dot. You see his face. You see him realizing he's been shot. You see him realizing he's going to die. And yeah, I think what you said about it being subtle is right. I mean, there's a lot of hammy dialogue we could plug in right as Holly and Harry kind of look at each other for the last time, and we don't get it. We kind of get that sense that he sees kind of how there's a look of resignation, I guess, right before he dies, that I took not to be, well, I'm cornered, this is over, but it kind of forced him into an understanding of this is how far I've come. You know, if Holly is, well, that's going to happen again. Eh?
I know. It's fine.
It's
just accept it.
So I get it. If Holly is what I used to be, and the me of the past meets the me of the present, and one of them kills the other one, you know, there's been this descent. You know, I'm not the person I used to be, and it's not because I've matured. It's because I've come to start taking advantage of other people. And, you know, we see them as kind of the same person, I think, most strongly there in that scene. And when he realizes he doesn't have the strength to get out, and I think he realizes, you know, to lift the super great, he realizes he doesn't have the strength to be a good person and to live life the hard way, which is not selling diluted penicillin to children. You know, he realizes he doesn't have that strength to be the person he wants to be the person he used to be. And it's kind of a self-judgment. And I think even though Orson Welles has such a small role in this movie as far as screen time, he still does get that arc of the man on the Ferris wheel versus the man in the sewer. I think are different people.
Yeah, for sure.
Anything else about it?
No, I think that's about it.
Go see this movie, Alistair, because I know you listen to this without seeing it. So just go see it. It's a really good movie. And yeah, I think it's a lot of its strength just comes on how, I mean, it's more slowly paced than a modern movie is, but there's so much in it that in those moments where it does slow down, there's a lot to consider and a lot to appreciate about the movie. So
yeah,
it's more than a good watch.
Yeah. And I mean, for a movie from the 1940s, it feels fast paced, you know, like it feels, right. That's another thing that I feel feels more modern about the movie than a lot of the things that came out around the same time. It is a quickly moving movie. I mean,
helps that too.
Yeah, that is 100% true. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I'm still sort of piecing together how modern this movie felt, and I saw it a week and a half ago. You know, so yeah, it's wonderful, and everybody should see it. And yeah, The Third Man, good times.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.